and Spanish language programming created and produced right here at KPFT. Don't miss a second on HD2. Mouse on over to kpft.org or on TuneIn Radio today. KPFT, Houston.
Okay, KPFT listeners, the unruffled beat of Ray Lynch's Clouds Below Your Knees signals 8 p.m. Wednesday and time for So What's Your Story? The only program originating in Houston devoted entirely to storytelling, and it's right here on listener-sponsored KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston. I'm your host, Dr. Mary Edgerton, and along with an ensemble of gifted hosts, Dr. Hank Rubicek, our show's founder, Greg Audell, appearing with Floyd the Wonder Dog, and Dr. Warren Holloman, our master of wellness, we bring to you storytellers every week. Now, these hosts are not only gifted hosts, they are also great storytellers. Along with the team rounding it out, we have our stellar intern, who is also our acting chief engineer and media maven, Tatiana Gago. Together with our guest storytellers that we bring on the show every week, we celebrate the power of story. Stories are quite something. It's almost difficult to define the extent to which a story connects the storyteller to the story listener. I have mentioned in the past some of the brain studies that have been performed that demonstrate how the brains of the storyteller and the story listener synchronize as the story progresses. The listener doesn't just embark upon a journey that is orchestrated by the teller. It's more as though the listener ends the world of the storyteller, that story that is being seen and felt through the storyteller's visual and emotional lens, and travels with the storyteller. It's a journey within a journey. Tonight, you will experience a number of these special journeys, as I have invited a cast of storytellers to talk about their travel adventures. I live for traveling like I live for storytelling. Each trip is a special adventure, and when I get back home, I feel ever more in wonder of the world in which we live. Traveling makes for some great stories, and my guests tonight aim to prove it. I am joined here by three adventurous travelers and storytellers for my on-the-road show with Paul Topikian, Dr. Peter Hu, and Mark Bailey. Paul Topikian, many of you know from past shows here on So What's Your Story? Moth fans will also know him as a frequent storyteller and Story Slam winner. He was born and raised in Yonkers, New York, and yes, I hear a little bit of it in his accent.
Just a little bit.
But he's lived here in Houston for more than 30 years. In 2004, Paul and his family relocated to Guatemala for 3 years for work, and there they had the opportunity to travel extensively throughout Central America. I'm just going to throw in here, Paul's also a scuba diver, so he travels both above and below water. And Paul, I don't know if you know this, but I'm also a scuba diver. But we're going to save those exciting stories, those out-of-breath moments, for another night. And guys, we're both alive, okay? So tonight, we're going to hear about travels at sea level and above. I also have here Dr. Peter Hu, a professor of molecular diagnostics at the MD Anderson School of Health Professions, and currently their interim dean. Tonight, he will be telling us about a very interesting trip to Africa. In fact, I met Peter while we were traveling in Africa together as part of a program to address cancer diagnosis in several African low- and middle-income resource countries. And I have to tell you that one of my favorite parts of the trip would be to sit in the hotel lounge at the end of the evening after dinner and listen to Peter tell stories. You guys are in for a treat. Along with Peter, Mark Bailey is here from the MD Anderson School of Health Professions. Mark is a professor of histopathology. And maybe some of y'all might remember that I am a pathologist. He and I came to know each other in this same program I just described to improve diagnostics in low- and middle-income resource countries in Africa. Now, we've had our own very interesting journeys. We never leave a city without a visit to its morgue and laboratory for forensic pathology. It's become a tradition, but we're going to leave those for another night. So, everybody, I have been looking forward to this show for so long. Paul, Peter, and Mark, welcome. Paul, I know that you've been on the radio with me and with Hank and with Greg. So, making the rounds of the hosts?
Yeah, I think the only one I've not been on with is Dr. Holman.
Yeah, well, I'm going to talk to him about that. Now, Peter, welcome to the show. I can't tell you how much I've enjoyed your stories during our trips, and I'm excited to introduce you as a storyteller to our audience. So, I do know this is your first time on the radio, and to boot, as a storyteller, how do you like it?
Mary, very glad to be here. I've also been looking forward to this for a long time. So, hopefully, my story tonight will be of an interesting one to the audience.
Oh, it will. I know. Now, Mark, I don't know where to begin with you. I mean, I have to tell you, Mark and I work the closest together when it comes to our efforts to impact cancer diagnosis and care in Africa. I would never have survived without your sense of humor, your constant storytelling, your shared interest in touring the morgue in every institution in every country we visited, and those cheese crackers that you had on hand time I needed a little something when I felt
snacks.
Nauseated. Yes, yes. It's like, oh, Mark, I don't feel so good. Here, I got cheese crackers. And let me add your own dedication to making improvements in cancer care. So, Mark, I know we were mentioned together in the Lusaka Times newspaper, even if our TV interview that visit did not get aired. But you did tell me that your radio days actually began long ago.
Oh, yes. Long, long time ago. And first of all, I'm so happy to be here, and thank you for inviting me to be on the show. But yes, in the late 70s, I aspired when I was in high school to be a radio producer. And so I tried to, I was an assistant producer for the one Houston Astros game on the radio. And then later on, it went on to a station, I think it still exists in Houston, KRBE, and promoted a concert. So had a little bit of fun with that, but it wasn't my calling.
Well, welcome back, and here you are as a storyteller, your own venue. Well, let's get started. So, Paul, I know that you have visited numerous countries. I think you said at least 30. But there's one particular story from your 3 years in Guatemala that has stayed with you. Can you please take us on that journey?
Absolutely. So I was sitting in my office. It was a Monday morning, and Sylvia Arbasu bursts in, and she is just bubbling with excitement. She's telling me about this trip she took over the weekend to Coban, which was off in the sort of northeast part of Guatemala, kind of off in the hinterlands, to a place called Samuc-Champey, which sounds really, really cool. But she was just going on and on about this place. You have got to go. It's the most amazing place in the world. Two rivers cross one another. And I'm looking at Sylvia and I'm like, two rivers cross one another? How does that happen? And she's explaining it. There's a limestone bridge that one river has formed over another, and this one river dives under it, comes out the other side, and there are all these pools, and it's just magical, and it's amazing, and you have to go. And it sounded pretty darn cool, so we decided we would make a trip there. My in-laws were coming, and we decided this would be a good place to take them. It sounded really, really cool. It was a trip out into the country. Coban sounded interesting. It's a town of about 80,000 in the middle of nowhere. It's been around from the 1500s. Let's do it. And so we planned to do it. Now, when you were making a trip in Guatemala, this is back 2005 time period, you don't have TripAdvisor, you don't have Google Maps, you don't have any of the things that we use today. So you really need all of the details. Where are you going? Where are you going to stay? If you can identify where you're going to stay, how do you identify how to get to it? Because once you get out of Guatemala City and you get out into the country, you start finding that roads aren't marked, roads have names, but nobody puts the name on the road. And so knowing where the Blue Cross is, the Cruz Azul, becomes a very important thing, because you need to make a left at Cruz Azul or you'll never find your way to the hotel. So I got all the details, where we were going, where the gas stations were, what we needed to bring. There was not very good wine supply in Coban, so we needed to plan ahead and bring a couple of bottles with us. And we had all of this information together, all except one little detail. So we took off. The plan was that we would go on a Friday, and it took about 5.5 hours to go from Guatemala City to Coban. Now, this is not a very long trip. It's only about 150 miles as you drive. But given the roads in Guatemala and navigating through the mountains and up and down and around, it takes about 6.5 hours. One of the other things we had learned relative to taking off and going someplace in Guatemala was knowing where you were going was important, because our Spanish was, as it was described, either mine was either horrible or un gran chiste, one big joke. And so asking as you were traveling where you were going to get directions was not something that you wanted to do. So we headed out, traveling through the rainforest, traveling through the cloud forest, past small coffee fincas, large coffee fincas, up over a ridge, down through a pass, into a desert area, back up into the clouds, and got to Coban. The hotel there was quite delightful, rustic, but realistic. And the restaurant that we had been advised to go to was quite good also. And it turned out the information we had gotten about wine was wrong. You could get a good $10 bottle of Chilean wine in Coban, which was quite nice. The Saturday plan was that we were going to leave at 9. It was about a 2.5 to 3 hour drive from Coban to Samuk. And it's only 60 miles. It's one of these things where the first 50 miles are really quick, and then you go off of the, as they would say in Guatemala, you go off the hard road. And that doesn't mean that you're going onto an easy road. It just means you're going onto a road that's either going to be a dirt track or cobblestones, or it could be these corduroy log roads that they've made. It was just not going to be a good paved road. And we made our way, and we were doing fine. We were heading for a little town called Languin, St. Augustine Languin. And from there, it was probably another 15 kilometers to Samuk. Languin is a small town in the middle of nowhere, probably about 5,000 people total. And they are of Mayan heritage, largely Quiche. They speak Spanish, but it's not their first language. The Indian language is their first language. So our poor Spanish and their second language Spanish is somewhat of a disaster in the making. Anyhow, we got through there, found the road that we needed to go to Samuk, and took off. Now, one of the things I'll say about Quiche and the folks in that area, and this is, I think, generally true about Guatemala, they have a high regard for fellowship, for fellow man, for family. And they hold that in high regard, and that thankfully would prove to be something of value to us. Now, I said that we had not gotten one piece of information that we needed, and that was that we really needed a four-wheel drive vehicle. Sylvia had given me all this information, and she drove this Mazda CRX, CRV, I don't know what it was, but it was like this blue Mazda sports car. And I had a Toyota CRV, which I figured, if she could get there in her sports car, I could get there in my CRV. Little did I know that they had hired a four-wheel drive at the hotel that we had stopped at. So off we had gone with our two-wheel drive, front-wheel drive car, attempting this trip. This was a mistake. We were about a kilometer away from our destination, going down this huge hill, which had a hard left turn, down into a little valley, and then up the other side. I should also point out at this point that it was the rainy season. So it's not like there's pouring rain. It's just everything is wet. There's always this constant mist. There's always wetness. The cobblestones were wet. The mud was wet. This was not a good recipe for driving five people in a CRV up a hill. And indeed, I made three runs trying to go up the final hill to Samuk Champeh, and neither time could I make it up over the hill. Okay, I'm not going to do that. I don't want to put the car in the ditch. Besides, I don't have any cell phone coverage out here. This could be really disastrous. We'll just go back to town. And so I turned around and I attempted to go back the way I had come, only to find out that that left turn going downhill was a sharp right turn going uphill, and I could make it to the right turn, but I couldn't make the right turn and continue up. Okay, got to figure something out. This is not good. Back down, wait, no cell phone coverage. We're going to need a rescue. But from whom? Well, it's not clear. So we sat for a while. Wasn't really much to do. The longer we sat, the more tense I got. And unfortunately, my reaction to tension is generally to get sick to my stomach. And ultimately, that's what I did about 20 minutes into waiting with no cars coming by. So I made a quick detour to the right into the bushes and relieved myself of what had been a delightful breakfast. My mother-in-law, who was with us, had sort of a similar reaction, but a different orifice. She went the other direction off of the road. Suffice to say, we had things kind of covered on both sides. And we waited, and there was really nothing else to do. And then our saviors came in the form of a group of Mexicans coming in a Dodge Caravan. They made it down the hill to where we were, started to go up the other hill, couldn't do it, turned around, tried to go back the other way. Oh, great. Now we have two cars stuck in the same place. We tried pushing both cars. We tried pushing theirs. They tried pushing ours. We tried pushing together. We tried with people in it. I even got creative and to back, you know, maybe the front wheel drive is not helping. None of this worked. And so we sat and we waited. The next car coming by, which is probably about 30 minutes later, was a Subaru driven by an American couple who were carrying their dry cleaning with them. Don't ask me where they had gotten that from out in the middle of nowhere. They were going off to their cabin, which was the other side of the hill up near Samuk. They stopped, looked at the RAV4, looked at me, and said, "You're screwed." Rolled their windows up and took off. Okay, fine. Now what do we do? And we waited. Enter the Eggman. This Jeep comes down the hill from the other side, and I'm talking about an old gray Willys Jeep. We're talking a Jeep that was built World War II era. And it's driven by a man, and he's got his two sons, and it's loaded with eggs. Cartons and cartons and cartons of eggs. He's the Eggman. He delivers all of the eggs from the various different farms into Lenguin to be sold at the market. He looked at us, shook his head, and said, "I'll be back in 35 minutes. Now, this, to me, was amazing. The notion that somebody would come back in 35 minutes, give you that kind of time precision in Guatemala, was crazy. In Guatemala, things happened at their own time, and if people told you they were going to be at your house at 7, they might not show up until 8 or 8:30. So the notion that he would come back in 35 minutes, I thought, was absurd. He drove off, delivered the eggs. Lo and behold, he was back in 35 minutes. And he had cables with him. Now, cables, you know, translates into rope. I was hoping he had real cables. And what he had was effectively clothesline rope, which didn't work. We tried to pull. We ripped the clothesline. This is not going to work. No worries. I have another idea. Okay, I started calling him Don Huevos because I didn't know what to call him. I didn't know his name. Don Huevos is going to go off and get some white powder. Can I give him 10 Q? This was equivalent of giving him about a dollar and a quarter. And I thought, a dollar and a quarter for white powder, that's not very much money. What kind of white powder are you going to get? Well, it turns out he came back with white powder that you would use to throw under the tires. It was calcium or talc, and it was amazing. Thrown under the tires, sucks the water out, creates friction, and he shepherded both us and the Mexicans in the caravan out of our place where we were stuck. It was a quite amazing experience. There were other things that happened on this trip that made it challenging getting back to where we had gone to, but the thing that just sort of struck me about the whole experience was this man spent probably 3 hours with us, and we were in the middle of nowhere, and he didn't need to do it, but that's what people did. That's what I found was typical of traveling in Guatemala. They would do whatever they needed to do to help somebody out, whether they knew them or they didn't. And suffice to say, he shepherded us back to Langin. I tried to give him some money to help him for the work that he had done for us. Obviously, we had disrupted his day. He would have nothing of it. And off we went. Was quite an amazing experience. We were quite lucky to have gotten out of there.
Oh, that's truly a wonderful story. I mean, while you're sitting down there, did you wonder if this was the end of the world for you?
Well, I didn't think it was the end of the world, but it certainly was stressful enough that it got me in the bushes, sort of evacuating my stomach. But what I was very nervous about was the whole notion of being stuck out in the middle of nowhere with no cell phone. I mean, this may seem strange, but, you know, back then, that cell phone was like a lifeline. And if I couldn't call one of the guys that I worked with at the center and ask questions to find out how to get out of whatever predicament that I was in, I really felt naked. And that was, I think, the thing that scared the most of me about that situation.
I don't think cell phones have diminished within our culture. I leave home without mine. I mean, not that I didn't do that for the first 50 years of my life, and I'm suddenly, oh my God, I don't have my cell phone. I've got to go back home. So was there something in particular about the man that made you open up to him, feel good?
Well, he was just, the thing that struck me about it was he just projected this, don't worry, I'm going to take care of you. I'm taking you under my wing, and I'm going to solve this problem for you. And he did. It was really quite amazing experience.
And lovely. I like the word lovely. I don't think we use it often enough. Well, I'm going to go to Peter and Mark now and remind you all that just before our team went to Rwanda last November, we were talking about making a trip to see the silverback gorillas because we knew we would be in that area. And I know that the two of y'all were able to get one organized and go. So, Mark, I thought you might want to start telling us about the journey, how it
It was a complex journey, but I'll try to do the best I can in a few minutes. But, you know, as we all remember the history of Rwanda, one of the most unfortunate things that comes to mind when you think about the country of Rwanda is the in 1994 when there was the genocide and the civil war between the two ethnic groups of the Hutus and the Tutsis. So, you know, as a backdrop to our journey to see the gorillas in Uganda, you're thinking about this. And we in the course of about 100 days, just think about that, in 3 months, there was nearly 1 million people that were slaughtered due to ethnic cleansing. And so it's a very sad thing to think about. And you're thinking about this as you're being picked up at 3 o'clock in the morning at your hotel. So one of the things that really surprised me at 3 o'clock in the morning in Kigali, Rwanda, was how busy the streets were. The streets are very busy, a lot of activity on the street, lots of lights on, lots of people out, lots of stuff going on. So, you know, by 2016, you know, we're in Rwanda, and things had become peaceful. People were getting along, and remembering the genocide, they were regretting the past atrocities and trying to make up for what had gone wrong, so wrong, by paying homage to the victims. And so one of the areas that we were traveling to, we were going down this road from Kigali to Uganda, and it was in the Kanuga district, which is the southwestern district of Uganda. So you have to also remember that there are still some groups of people that are still dissatisfied with the government in Rwanda. So you have these rebel guerrillas that are not only in the mountainous area of Rwanda, but also to the very area that we're traveling to go see some guerrillas. So you have these things in your mind. You're thinking all kinds of crazy things. So our driver did give us a very lengthy history of the country and when it was colonized by the Belgian government and going all the way back to the beginning of the 20th century and telling us all kinds of interesting history about this, what had happened. And so as I said before, we're traveling down this very dark road to Uganda. And what was really interesting to me, it was so dark, even with the headlights, you could not see the road very well. And what I began to see was these mounds of, like, bushes that were moving along the side of the road, and I couldn't quite figure out what was this. And it dawned on me, it was people that had their bicycles loaded with tea leaves. So we were in the heart, or the district of Rwanda and Uganda, where there are large tea farms, where most of the tea that we drink comes to the United States. That's where it comes from, the teas, the different teas that they grow there. When on the way to Uganda, we really didn't think about it. You know, when Peter and I were planning on doing this guerrilla trip, we didn't really look at the background of where we were going. Once we get to going down this dark road and we are near Uganda and we're getting ready to make the border crossing, before you can get through the little town of Kisoro, which is actually part of Uganda, you have to go through this section called No Man's Land. And again, like I mentioned before, it's in the Kanunga district of Uganda. And it's about 5:30 in the morning. It's pitch dark. But there are a lot of people in the No Man's Land just walking around, milling around. We go through the Rwanda No Man's Land border crossing. There was no hold up. They just waved us through. And then we drove about a half mile. Then we got out of our car. The driver said, "You need to go over to this building." He just pointed to this building. And so Peter and I are looking at each other, and it was dark, and we didn't really know what he was talking about. So he said, "Just go. He pointed at us, and we walked up. And it was a well-lit building, old building. And there was these two people, immigration officers, in there. And they looked at us, and they asked what we were going to do in Uganda. And we told them we're going to go on this guerrilla trip. So that was really easy getting into the country of Uganda. And not really realizing that we were kind of in a dangerous area. And like I said before, there was some Rwanda guerrilla groups that were in that area as well. It was kind of like dumb luck that we didn't know where we were. And so finally, we had about another hour's drive to get to the Bwindi Ugandan National Park, or the Bwindi, or they call it Bwindi when you translate it into English, means the impenetrable forest. And it literally is, I don't know if you remember the movie Gorillas in the Mist, but when you look out over the mountains, you see this mist just covering the mountains, and that's exactly what it looks like. The elevation is about 3,500 to 8,500 feet. And so we were going back up to this area to where we got to the national park, and we were led in to go to the areas where we were supposed to meet the Ugandan rangers. And what's interesting is that this is also the area close to the Republic of Congo, where Diane Fossey did her study with the gorillas as well. And so we're in that vicinity. And it was astonishing to me to find out that there are only about 400 gorillas in this region, which represents about half of the world's population of gorillas in the whole world. So that's just astonishing when you think about that. And so it really it set up what was going to be a very interesting expedition and a very laborious one. When we got to the park, we met the rangers, and then we were subsequently kind of categorized into how fit are you and what group are you going to go with. Peter's going to go into more of that. But we got there, but we just didn't really realize how dangerous it was, the dangerous territory we were driving through. And so I'll leave it there, and we'll listen to what the next part.
Didn't you tell me that you underwent a lot of interrogation on these borders?
Yes, so that was on the way back. So when we were finished with the expedition, and we were driving back to the Ugandan-Rwandan border, get to Uganda, to the no man land border, and we're just waved through, no problem. But our driver all of a sudden says, "Get out of the car." And so we're saying, okay. So we didn't really ask them why. Why do we need to get out of a car? We didn't understand why. He says, "Get out of the car and walk about a mile and a half to the Rwandan immigration office." And so we're walking down the street, and we were so tired from the trip, and I don't think we cared where we were or what happened to us. And so we just kind of naively were walking down the middle of the street, and we had people approaching us. They wanted to exchange currency with us. They wanted this. They wanted that. So we get to the Rwandan immigration office, and my fellow travelers, there was two, Peter and another person, and they just look at their passport and wave them through like, no big deal. So I go up to the immigration officer, and the immigration officer looks at me. He's looking at me funny. And, you know, I'm kind of wearing, tonight here at the radio station, I'm kind of wearing what I was wearing that day.
If you're on Facebook Live, take a look.
So if you look at it closely, it kind of looks like kind of a military hat, military gaiter.
Yeah. Camo.
Something that you might go on a safari. But this immigration officer was really eyeballing me, and he started asking me a number of questions. He said, what were you doing in Uganda? And I said, I went on a gorilla trip to see the gorillas. He says, okay, are you telling the truth? And I said, yes, here's my friends. Here's the driver. We went on a gorilla touring trip. He says, okay. He says, now why you need to go to Rwanda? And I told him, well, I'm here with a group from the United States, and we're here at a medical conference, and we had the conference in Kigali. And he says, well, I'm not really sure, but I'm going to just trust my heart and let you in to country. And he stamped my passport, and he let me through. But wow, was I sweating. I was really sweating because I didn't realize that I must look like the ugly American, but I'm not. I'm very respectful of the countries in that area.
I think maybe not just the ugly American, but, you know, camo in an area, a rebel-led area. What were you thinking?
I was not thinking. I was thinking I was excited about the gorilla being out in the trees wanting to be camouflaged so I could get up and close and personal to the gorillas. That's all I was thinking.
So was that the only problem you encountered in crossing borders, or do you have a black cloud?
Oh, boy, let me tell you. So a few days later, when we're departing from Rwanda, Kigali, to Ghana, we had to go, you know, you have to go through the exit immigration office line again. And so, this time, my fellow travelers were behind me. I went first. And I'm still wearing the same hat and still the same shirt that I was wearing on the gorilla trip. And the officer asks me, looks at me very sternly, and he says, you're an American. And I said, yes, I am. And he says, what do you think about our country? I said, lovely country. Rwanda is lovely. I enjoy being here and helping and assisting in bringing medical procedures to your country. And he says, do you love Rwanda? And I said, And I looked back around to my friends, and I had this strange look on my face, I'm sure. And I said, excuse me. And he says, do you love Rwanda? And I said, yes, I do. I love your country very much. It's a lovely country. I want to come back and visit it. And he says, will you swear on the Bible that you love Rwanda? And I said, yes, I will. Do you have a copy of the Bible? He says, no, I don't. But I just wanted to see if you would swear on the Bible that you love our country. So I did have some immigration issues in that country. But let me tell you, Rwanda is a lovely country. The people are loving. And it's an awesome place to visit.
Rwanda is a remarkable country. I have to say, Peter and I are here, and we went through the same customs, sailed through. Nobody asked me if I loved Rwanda, which I did love Rwanda, and nobody asked me to swear on the Bible. You might not want to take that little camo thing with
you
next time.
Yes, I think I will leave it home next time.
So, folks out there, we are here on So What's Your Story, broadcast live every Wednesday at 8 p.m. on KPFT 90.1 FM Houston, 89.5 in Galveston, and 91.9 in Huntsville, or live streaming from anywhere in the ether on kpft.org. We look forward to our weekly show and the opportunity to be an important part of the Houston storytelling scene, which we're going to hear a little more about from Tatiana Gago. But before I close out and hand over to Tatiana, I want to remind everybody that our guests tonight for the On the Road story are Paul Topikian, Mark Bailey, and Peter Hu. So, Tatiana, hello back there.
Hello.
I have to say, when I graduated from college, my parents were shocked that I would think of going anywhere abroad. How about you? You're a college student. What do your parents think of you getting up and going someplace?
Oh, I know my mom would certainly love me going, like, studying abroad, because she studied actually in Cambridge. My dad, his form of studying abroad was going here. So I think studying abroad would be actually a really good idea for my parents, or have me to go to, like, a good dream, really.
Well, I'm going to cut this short, but I'm just going to say you're very lucky, because when I graduated from college, I gave myself a trip to Mexico City as a gift. I went with my college roommate, and my parents came along as our chaperones. Okay, but let's talk about storytelling. I know that even though we are the only live radio storytelling show, there are other storytelling venues in our community. Can you share some of those with us?
Oh, Mary, you know I always have something to say. But first, let me say something about our show. If you don't have a radio, it's absolutely no excuse for missing it, because you can listen to us stream live, not only on kpft.org, but on Facebook Live, on our So What's Your Story Facebook page. And there are other important storytelling announcements from our sponsor, the Houston Storytellers Guild, which is the best group to work with to start cultivating your storytelling skills. Just get to their monthly story swaps held on the fourth Tuesday of every month from 7 to 8:30 p.m., located at Temple Emanuel, at 1500 Sunset. You know, you can go to their website, www.houstonstorytellers.org, for upcoming events like Skyline Screamers on Saturday, October 20th. You know, spooky season is about to come, so get yourself a blanket, because it might get cold, and you might need to hide under that blanket as well. And a beginner storytelling workshop conducted by Dr. Michael Winters and Dr. Hank Rubicek at the Classical Theater Company on Saturday, September 22nd at 4617 Montrose. The Guild site gives all the details that you need. And also, that site has all of our past So What's Your Story programs, every show since 2008, listed on the menu under Radio Program.
Oh my God, I so love that site. I just want to emphasize, yes, you can listen to our old shows over and over again. I do it. Yes, I do it. You may... I don't think I'm the only one who does that. But, sorry to interrupt, because I just want to say, I love the oldies but goodies, and I'm an oldie.
Mary, you don't look past 25.
Oh, so sweet.
You are not old, but we also think you're a goodie. We also post on YouTube, so you can check out our program clips there. And you can tell us what you think about our shows or suggest program ideas by visiting our So What's Your Story Facebook page. And we promise to get back to you. Please be sure to share our page with friends. And oh yes, we'd love it if you'd like us when you leave. And don't you miss our friends at the Moth at Warehouse Live, the second Tuesday of the month. And that is coming up next Tuesday, right around the corner, September 12th. The theme is going to be education. And I know Dr. Rubicek, who's sitting right next to me, has a good story to tell, especially about me. Good ones, I'm hoping?
Well, you know, I've had 11,000 students since 1983, so I have a few. And yeah, a few are about you.
That's great. And we have some educators back here on the storytelling side. So think about it, boys. Yeah. It's Tuesday. So what's happening here next week at 8 p.m.? And so what's your story here on KPFT 90.1?
Well, Mary, I do believe we have Dr. Warren Holloman next Wednesday, and he is hosting Sarah Moon Jewelry and Rachel Dixon with stories about resilience, ranging from living through Houston hurricanes to navigating Houston traffic, and for something special, navigating the Frio River in an inner tube.
Tubing on a river is on my bucket list. I don't know how to tell you, I haven't done that yet, although I grew up in Texas, but on my bucket list, soon to be crossed off. Now, speaking of resilience, Peter, we heard Mark's story about visiting the gorilla sanctuary. So did you encounter any drama trying to cross the border?
Oh, yes. Well, like Mark said, as we're crossing the border to no man's land, bear in mind, anything could happen here, and I don't think either side of the government would care. There are people sitting around, loitering around, looking at us. And we're at the visa, getting our visa stamped, while Mark was being questioned by the people. I was looking on the side, and there were posters of the genocide poster, wanted posters of the warlords that were still out there. And they all had American dollar bounties on their heads. And that's when the reality hit us, that we are in a very dangerous place. So to continue on with the story, I grew up in the American cinema, so everything to me have lots of comparisons to the movies I've watched. We reached the base camp of the Bwindi Impenetrable Forest around 8 a.m. We were at around 75 to 8,000 feet elevation. Now, when I see the word impenetrable forest, in my mind, I was thinking of the forest, the elven forest of the Lord of the Rings, where they're really up to your face and you really can't get through it. We were so high, and there were plenty of cloud patterns beneath us, but it was very different than what I had expected. In fact, the forests were vast, and they were very tall, as tall as you can see. And so when we got there, we were met by a few jungle trackers, all carrying machetes, and of course the Army Rangers carrying the machine guns for the debriefing. I guess the guns were for the wild animals, and just in case other freedom fighters, as they were known, activists, guerrillas, fighters just the south of us in the Volcano National Forest area. So during the debriefing, we were told that a group of advanced trackers discovered the movements of one of the families. But the Kura, which was one of the largest guerrilla families in the forest with four silverbacks totaling 14 members. You see, the guerrilla families gets up early in the morning and begin their movements through the mountain forest until they identify the spot where they would build their nest for the day and start foraging afterwards. This could take anywhere from 0.5 kilometers to as much as 10 kilometers each day. So the only way to find them is for the advanced team track their tracks early in the morning and until they locate their nest for the day. If the trackers could not find them, then that day's trip is canceled. There is no photography. So although these gorilla families were habituated, meaning they perceive humans as non-threatening, but still the boundaries must be respected because they were still considered wild, and therefore all the jungle laws still resides. What I had envisioned for this trip prior to our arrival came from the movies, in that we will walk into the jungle that's more or less flat plain, and all of a sudden, look, here are the gorillas, and they're sitting there waiting for us to get close to take photos. I couldn't have been more wrong. We first started trekking, just had to imagine, and walk into the jungle via a trail full of vines on the ground as well as trees and bushes to navigate through. I was thinking to myself, this looked real enough. However, that only lasted about 200 yards. Then things literally turned sideways. Our lead tracker pointed to his right,
which was a 6-degree uphill climb, and said to us, "Now we begin." For the next few kilometers, we went up and down, and up and down some more, through trees, bushes, dead branches, and vines, on top of wet, slippery mud, climbing, then sliding, and falling, and repeating it to what it seemed to no end. There were moments where I wanted to give up, because every part of my body was sore, and I had muscle cramps that I didn't know existed. Bear in mind, we were high in altitude, which meant low oxygen. It was hot, due to the clothes I was wearing. My ignorance and naivety told me to buy really expensive jungle clothes that was pre-soaked with bug repellent. I was sweaty, thirsty, smelled like DEET, and a sunburn all at the same time. Needless to say, at that time, I was somewhat delirious, just going through the motion than anything else. I distinctly remember the lead tracker shouted to all of us, "Watch out for the potholes full of water, because most likely they were created by jungle elephants, and you don't know how deep it really is." I was like, "Huh? On top of everything else, there are elephants we have to watch out for? This is crazy." We continued further into the jungle, and by that time I was pretty sure I was hallucinating as well, when all of a sudden we saw the lead tracker raise his arm, and we all stood still, except for me because I was bent over, gasping for air. We slowly crept upwards, and right in front of us we saw the first gorilla. It was a small male foraging. Mind you, the typical gorilla family foraging area is quite large. We were given the signal to spread out. I had the pleasure of locating a female mother with a baby, which is a rare encounter in itself, as well as two of the silverbacks. One was sitting down relaxing, and the other was actually walking towards us. We were literally inches from them, and they just ignored us and walked by. It was one of the most invigorating moments in my life, full of adrenaline and fear all at the same time. So after a few moments of soaking in that experience, I wanted to go back to the female mother and take a few more photos. This time the mother and her baby had moved further up on the slope, so I thought I could also do the same and climb a little further and get as close as possible so I can take really good photos. However, I grabbed hold of a bad vine, and on my way up, at the same time I missed a step and twisted my torso as I fell towards her. This was not a good move. As she thought I was reaching for her baby, she let out this huge scream and charged towards me as my back was facing her. Now, at this point, things were moving very slow motion in your mind when you're in life and death situations. Thoughts were going through my mind, thinking that what's going to happen at this point. I thought if she just pounced on my back, I could take a few hits and I would be okay. But what if she bit me? And if she bit me, I would have all types of infections and I would still be in the middle of the jungle.
A scientist.
And so at that time, I was very scared. But immediately, one of the trackers took the machete and lunged right between me and the gorilla in an attacking position. Now, immediately he raised his machete. It took the attention away from me, and the mother gorilla was looking at him. And he began making this grunting noise. This nonstop grunting noise. And then the mother looked at him, and then for a brief second, I can feel the breath of the mother gorilla breathing down my neck. And she took a step back and literally just sat down and ignored all of us and began eating again. And at that time, I was very tired and sore, and I had no strength left. I didn't know what to do. The lead tracker looked at me and waved at my camera, made this gesture to have me pull my camera out. So I'm thinking, okay, what is he doing? I pulled the camera out. He slowly took the camera away from my hands, and he looked at me, and he made this smile gesture. And then he began snapping photos of me sitting there. I think he snapped maybe 50 photos really fast with his hands. I can see his finger just pushing fast as he can. Then he gave the camera back to me, and slowly they dragged me away from the mother gorilla. So that was that experience. And after that, we have the other part of the story I will tell in a second.
Okay, so I have to say, I had talked about going on this trip with you. Woo! I think I dodged a bullet. Although, I do have to say, there has to be something really special about saying a mother gorilla breathed down my neck, ready to attack me and walked away and went back to eat. I mean, that's priceless. So now that all this had happened, it seems like everything else would be anticlimactic. So you have another story about going downhill?
Oh, yes. That was only the first half. So we were there for about an hour, taking photos, trying to find the rest of the families, get as much of that in as possible. But sometime earlier, I had begun thinking about the return. At that point, I was in so much pain and couldn't take another step. Now, mind you, I was sitting in a 60-degree angle on the side of a mountain where the base of my boots were against two of these tree trunks holding me up. The thought of traveling back the way we came in must have produced so much depression-related hormones that for a moment I felt total despair. I didn't care if I made it out alive, but literally I didn't care. I was swarmed by thousands of gorilla flies. And strange-looking bugs crawling over my boots and my pants, and I'm usually a bug-phobic type of person. At that moment, I just didn't care at all. I was sort of catatonic, and I mumbled the words, I can't do it. I just can't do it. The lead ranger looked at me, and then she stared at me for a moment, and then she waved at the lead tracker. The lead tracker walked up to me and basically looked at me for a moment and said, I will never forget this. Would you like a helicopter? With that one sentence, I was revitalized. All the happy hormones kicked in, and I kid you not, it was a night and day difference instantly. I asked him how much, and he said, how much you have on you? At that time, I had around $300. And he said, yeah, that's enough. And so I thought, I was going through my mind and thinking, this is one heck of a bargain. A helicopter ride through the jungle for $300. What a deal. I said to him, of course. And he said, okay. So he used his radio, and he spoke in their language, and turned to me and waved a gesture. Okay, they're on their way. I was relieved and alive again. So I was sitting there feeling cool the breeze of the mountain wind for the first time, and thinking, well, the helicopter should be hovering above me and then maybe drop the ladder for me to climb up. I think just like those Vietnam War movies in the jungle. And then I started looking around and noticed that's got to be one heck of a helicopter pilot because I saw no visibility around or above me. How is that person or how is that helicopter going to get there? So I asked the lead tracker, how is the helicopter going to navigate around this jungle? He looked at me with a slight smile and said, no, silly. This is Africa helicopter. I was more confused and said, well, what's that? And he said, you'll see. He began translating a short conversation to the others, and they started laughing too. So at that point, I was like, okay, something is up. What have I got myself into? So we waited around 20 minutes or so, and we heard sounds of more men showing up. But this time, there were at least half a dozen or two, maybe 10 men or so, and they had a stretcher with them. The lead tractor looked at me and pointed at the stretcher and said, African helicopter. I was relieved, but also very embarrassed at the same time, thinking to myself, I walk into the jungle, but going out on a stretcher. I couldn't say no, because a lot of men showed up, figuring if I said no now, they may carry me out in a different way. So I obliged and got on the stretcher. At first, my colleagues, Mark, were taking photos left and right. And I knew, oh God, they'll never let me hear the end of this. Because I was literally floating through the jungle. But I soon realized this was actually a very cool experience. And I was thinking, I was wondering if the ancient kings, when they traveled through the jungle, if that's how they felt. Except they were probably upright. And so we went through where it seemed like I was in all kinds of angles, but at any given time, and the men that were under me, they fell, they screamed, but at all the time, I never fell once. But because each time someone fell, another person would jump in and prop me up. So I was floating through the jungle and had the most enjoyable experience ever. I have forgotten everybody else around me. So after a good 15, 20 minutes of going through, we finally landed on the road.
And when
they slowly let me off. To be honest, I didn't want it to end.
That's a wonderful piece that I did miss. Well, we only have a couple of more minutes before we wrap up here. This has been a treat. I do have to stop and ask you, Mark, how come you didn't get the helicopter?
Well, that's really a funny question. So I'm with Peter and another friend that's on this trip, and we're relaying messages. We're yelling through the jungle, and all I hear is, helicopter, Peter's going out on a helicopter. So any minute I thought we were going to hear the helicopter coming in, because we got half the story just like Peter did. But it was quite an experience, and I was jealous of Peter, because going down the hill, the mountain, was much more difficult than climbing it, because it was so slippery and wet.
That was a one-person helicopter.
Yes.
So, Paul Topekian, Mark Bailey, Peter Hu, thank you very much for being on the show. This has really been a great experience. And I just want to say, I'd like to give a chance to each one of you to say something special to somebody in Radioland before we sign off. And we'll start with you, Paul.
I just want to say thank you to all the people that are listening, because this show wouldn't be here if it weren't for the fact that there were people out there listening to us. So
the story listeners.
All of you story listeners, thank you so much for supporting this program. It's really a wonderful thing.
And yes, and they do support us, and that is wonderful.
This is Mark. I would like to just thank all my colleagues that I've worked with in our African projects, and especially I want to thank my lovely wife, Jen, who's been patient with me through all my travel adventures that are work-related.
And Peter?
Mary, I want to thank you for giving me this opportunity. I had no idea. This is so much fun.
This is so much fun. Oh, and by the way, everybody out there, just want to say, from me, my message is Happy Jewish New Year. This weekend closes with Rosh Hashanah, and may you all have a very good and sweet year. But don't dare move. Hold that 90.1 position on the dial, because Wild Bill and the Vinyl Avenger are ready in the wings to share their cool classics with you. Make 90.1 a part of every day, and while you're driving home, turning in for the night, or just chilling, join us every Wednesday at 8 p.m. for So What's Your Story? Treasure what you hear. Keep loving great stories, and we'll keep bringing them to you. This is Mary Edgerton, and along with the rest of the So What's Your Story team, we never want you to forget that it's never too late to live happily ever after.
KPFT's local station board meeting will be held Wednesday from 7 to 10 p.m. at Montrose Center, 401 Brainerd Street. Public comment is allowed from 8 to 8:30. For more information, call 713-526-4000 or go to kpft.org.
KPFT Houston thanks our community partners. Artist Boat, a nonprofit organization providing inspiration and education through unique coastal experiences, including kayak adventures on the waters around Galveston Island and guided walking tours. Visit artistboat.org for more information. And AIDS Foundation Houston, offering free HIV testing every Monday, Tuesday, and Thursday. Visit AIDSHelp.org for more information. This is KPFT Houston.
Yes, this is KPFT Houston. Oh, it's that vinyl show!